Hello, Jason.
Hello, Stephen. Are we going to talk about space and related subjects here on this special Liftoff Members Edition thing that we're doing?
We're going to watch a movie instead.
Okay. Is it about space or related subjects?
It is.
Oh, good. Thank goodness. I already watched it, though. I don't really want to watch it again right now. I just watched it last night.
Yes. So. I did, too. It was my second viewing.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm double dosed.
Oh, yeah. You can... You can know things that maybe you noticed things the second way through that you did in the first. So we're talking about Stowaway, which is a movie on Netflix that was released this year. It is about a mission to Mars. Not the first mission to Mars. I thought that was actually pretty nice to not put that level of pressure on these characters who already are feeling a lot of pressure. It was directed by Joe Penna, written by Joe Penna and Ryan Morrison, and stars Anna Kendrick, Daniel Day-Kim, Shamir Anderson, and Toni Collette. They're the only four people in the movie.
That's one of the most interesting things about this, is that we never see anybody besides these four people, and we never really even hear anybody else either.
Yeah, there's just little voices that are like in the ears of people from like launch control and mission control, but that's about it. Yeah, it's a four character piece. It's kind of like a play, except the stage wouldn't be big enough for this because it's on a big spaceship.
Big spaceship, which I have some questions about how it's assembled, but we will get to that, I'm sure.
Yeah. I mean, that's one of the things that you know we're going to do on this podcast is apply science and crush the joy out of everything, because that's why we're here. The movie starts on launch from the inside with a shot of Anna Kendrick, and I thought that was a clever way. So this is a Netflix movie, right? It doesn't have a huge budget. And although there are special effects and there are some special effect sequences, I was struck by the fact that they don't have any Earth-bound sets. It's the spaceships. The whole way is just spaceships and the four characters. And not showing the launch, you save some money on that. You don't have to show a launch scene. They save their money for their big moments later. And they made some other choices that I think made this movie more economical. But I don't know. I find it, I like that kind of angle of it's just this character who's taking this ride into space. And that's how we do the launch. I did laugh at the time compression that goes on. Like the first stage seems to fire for a very short amount of time. They're onto the second stage while they're still passing through clouds. That seems wrong, but whatever.
They also call out Max Q in a weird time. It seems like. So Max Q, you may hear this if you watch a SpaceX launch or NASA launch or somebody.
They'll always tell you, yes.
That is the point at which the vehicle is in the most aerodynamic pressure. And they throttle down for Max Q, and then they throttle back up on the other side of it. It seemed very late. It seemed like maybe they were already in pretty thin atmosphere, but that was something I caught the second time around.
Yeah, I also noticed that they have windows out which they can see out of in the front of the spacecraft, which it would be covered in a fairing, but it's fine. You know, again, it's just one of those things that I thought was not how it would be done in real life, but I understand completely why they do that for the dramatic effect of it. Like nobody wants to see, like, because okay, so then they dock with the Mars transfer system. It's just called the MTS, and I laughed at that because it's we know how boring docking things in space is. It's super boring. Like it is the slowest. It's like watching a turtle cross a football field, let's say, because I don't want cars out there in this example. It's like watching a turtle cross a football field. Like turtle's moving, but you could really go get a sandwich and come back, order a pizza, have it delivered, eat the pizza, watch this movie, and then check on the turtle, and the turtle has moved. The turtle's at the 30-yard line or something, right? That's what space docking is. It is super slow and boring, and here it is not, friends. It's like, all right, like everything is collapsed together in a funny way. They're like, they go into Mars transfer orbit, which is weird because they're docking with the Mars transfer system. My theory is that's a spacecraft that is on that goes back and forth between Earth and Mars.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're getting, and I'm there's probably an article on the internet, and I didn't read it with the science consultant on this, but because they do a Mars transfer orbit and are leaving Earth orbit, which, by the way, they do immediately, which we also know would be something where they do like five orbits of Earth and make sure everything is okay. And then they would, you know, light the rocket and go into Mars transfer orbit. But then they have to dock with the MTS. It all happens very fast, which is fine because this would be like a 15-hour long movie if they did the docking sequences in proper time. But
see,
but
yeah, Interstellar.
The best I can come up with is, and this was at least my headcanon about what was going on here, is that the MTS is a spacecraft that goes between Earth and Mars, and so they have to get up to speed to match speed with it so that they can dock with it and take it back to Mars. That is one proposed way that you could do Earth-Mars stuff is like a transfer craft that never slows down. So you get on board, and then you take it to Mars, and then you get off. And you know you have to slow down, but it can just kind of keep going in its orbit. I don't know if that's what they're trying to do here, because otherwise it doesn't really make sense that they're getting up to Mars transfer speed and then they're docking with a vehicle. I don't really get that. But I didn't get it first that this is not the first mission to Mars either. It's like there's a colony on Mars mm-hmm. when this story is going on, because they kind of don't want to deal with any of that.
Yeah, and the commander, it is her third mission and her last one. She knows that going into it. So, yeah, I like that decision too.
Shades of Jim Lovell in Apollo 13, right? This is my last mission. Yeah.
Yeah. I think their mission number is 42 even. It's some big number. And so I like that too, that this has become a bit routine. And as we know from real life, when space missions become routine, that's generally when bad things happen. See Shuttle twice.
Sure.
I also thought it was, while we're talking about sort of things that this movie does, unlike other space movies maybe, we get the sense that the camera is weightless in the beginning. Like the camera's looking out the window, you know, over someone's shoulder, looking at the MTS where they have to dock, and the camera's sort of moving around mm-hmm. a little bit. But once they're attached to the MTS and they start to spin it, which becomes a plot line later that creates artificial gravity, the camera and all the action is just like it is on Earth. Like there's just regular gravity. And I would imagine that made this movie much cheaper and easier to make.
That was one of the thoughts that I had, was that this is how you make a space movie on a budget like this, is you spin up for artificial gravity. And yeah, they use it as a plot point, but also it doesn't mean you don't have to fake zero G. There's very little zero G fakery that goes on. There's like a necklace around Anna Kendrick. She's got a little necklace that floats at one point. And like there's some of it, but for the most part, this is able to be shot at 1G because they spin it up. Oh, talking about routine, I did want to mention Anna Kendrick and Daniel Day Kim. It turns out those their characters are they won a contest. It's not really quite that simple, but like you get the sense that the trips to Mars are so routine at this point that people basically make proposals to do research, and you get through the process and you're chosen. So they're scientists going to Mars as part of this mission, mm-hmm. We have our pilot, who is a grizzled astronaut veteran, but they're kind of novices because they're scientists. And I could quibble with the idea that you do a mission to Mars, but you only bring three people, and that two of them are not trained astronauts. But I think that's the point here, is that this is like the Mars shuttle, essentially. Mm-hmm. This is not anything that is spectacular and groundbreaking. This is just, we're taking a couple of scientists to Mars. Yeah. That's what we're doing.
Yeah.
The Mars colony.
Yeah, it puts it all in a very different state of mind than a lot of space movies that, hey, we're the first, we're doing something groundbreaking. This is just, hey, people going to Mars.
Yeah, it's that's not the point. And so that's all fine. So the spinning of the gravity, I had a moment where I was trying to figure out what the geography of this craft is, but it turns out that the movie does a very good job later of showing you exactly what the geography is, which is there's a crew compartment and there's like where all the volatiles are. It's where the oxygen is and, you know, all of that stuff. And it's on the far side. And then in the middle are solar panels. And so they spin up the whole thing, kind of spins like a pinwheel so that they have gravity. And that's the mechanism that allows them to shoot on a budget and creates the dramatic tension toward the end of the movie where they have to get from one side of the craft to the other via a tether.
Mm-hmm.
So do you have questions about the design of the spacecraft?
I mean, I was definitely confused the first time I saw it because like their launch vehicle, the Kingfisher, goes and attaches to the other end. I suppose that's for ballast so they can actually spin this thing.
Right.
And it makes much more sense the further you get into the movie. But at first you're like, wait, I don't quite get it. Because they have these couple of fast shots of basically it seems like it's not spinning when they reach it. And then they have to spin it once the rocket's on the far other end and then the tethers.
Right.
I guess unfurl. Right, and
if that's the Kingfisher, then I really don't understand what they're rendezvousing with. I don't know. I don't think I understand this spaceship completely. But
yeah.
But it's fine. It does that. I'm not sure that the idea of would you build a spacecraft that just is two masses along a tether with some panels at the center and spin it because you got to get the spinning. I'm thinking about the force involved. I'm sure there are engineers who have thoughts about this, but I don't know. It seemed a little bit baroque for me. I kind of expected it to be a more compact spinning design. I understand, having watched the rest of the movie, why it's not, but I think that's more for dramatic purposes than anything else. I don't know. I'd understand the other module being further away if it was like nuclear or something, and there's sci-fi stuff that does that. The idea that you keep your dangerous stuff away from you as a human. But I don't know. Anyway, so they end up in something that looks very much like an International Space Station module.
Mm-hmm.
That's been signed by a bunch of people. And so that was one of my questions is like, is that the implication that this thing has gone back and forth between Earth and Mars a bunch of times and those people signed it? Is that, or is it the people who built it or what? I didn't understand that part.
Yeah, I mean, there's a bunch of like mission patches stuck around. So I think it's people who have used it before.
Right, so that goes into the idea that this is a vehicle that transfers between Earth and Mars, and it's been used multiple times, and that's just part of the way that the system works. Because what's funny is that is not only is the design of the spacecraft, it's an ISS, like it's clearly it's based on ISS modules. That's what it looks like. It looks like it's the International Space Station, and the International Space Station has mission patches, and people sign them. So it's like a tip of the cap to that, but in a different context here. I didn't understand it when I first saw it, but it's fine. I just went with it. But yeah, it's clear upon viewing the whole movie that the idea here is that this is routine. This is just, mm-hmm. you know, it's nothing special there.
Yeah.
It's signed by people who've done this before. Plenty of people have done this before, I guess.
And the research that is being done seems to start at least in part on the journey.
Right.
So we have a couple of labs. We have where Anna Kendrick, her character's name is Zoe. She has a medical research facility of some sort. Mm-hmm. They're doing exercise, so like breathing masks. It's a little unclear what her research is, but she's also the doctor for the crew.
Right. And I was thinking she might be somebody who is going to do research on the people who are on the Mars colony.
Yeah, I kind of put that together.
When she gets there. Whereas Daniel Day Kim's character, David, he's growing plants. He's a botanist.
Mm-hmm.
He's growing plants. He's doing research about plants and plants generating oxygen from carbon dioxide and all this stuff. And so he's growing plants and he's going to grow some algae when he gets to Mars. And that also becomes important later when things go sideways for this. But that's what their science is. And then Toni Collette is just, she's just in charge.
Yep. She's the commander.
She's the captain. Yep. This gets us to the big, the driving part of the plot, right? Because up to now, it's just sort of like, do-do-do, we're going to Mars. Yeah, not much here. Again, just going to Mars, whatever. I'm sure it'll be fine. Otherwise, why would they make a movie about it? And that's when we get the moment where in the life support module, there is something weird is going on and there's like something's dripping out and it's like, what is that? And Toni Collette unscrews the panel and a guy falls on her.
There's a dude. There's a dude in the wall.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is your plot point, which is Michael is apparently an engineer who was working on the spacecraft. He's a launch pad engineer. And, you know, it's not gone into with any great detail, but it looks very much like he fell and was knocked unconscious and nobody noticed that he was gone. And so he you know, this is the premise. You've got to go with it. He ends up on the mission because, and I think there's an implication there too, that maybe the mission even like doesn't have the right weight and they need more thrust and stuff because there's an extra person on board. I'm not sure if that's enough mass to do that. But anyway, yeah. So there's an extra guy. They got an extra guy. Mm-hmm. What the hell is this? And he's wounded. He's got a big wound in his side and he's unconscious and there's an extra guy. Plus, this has led to his popping out of there and falling has led to damage in the life support system,
right,
which is going to drive the plot, because without that, they can't recycle their air and pull carbon dioxide out as effectively. They do a bunch of lithium hydroxide canister switching, which is straight up Apollo tip of the cap. They've got cylindrical lithium hydroxide canisters to filter carbon dioxide out of the air of the spacecraft, but that's a temporary solution, and it's going to be a problem because how are they going to be able to get enough air to breathable air to get to Mars? But meanwhile, there's a very effective scene where Michael wakes up and is shocked to
freaks
look outside
out
the window and see that the Earth is out there and he's not on it.
Maybe don't put the guy who fell into your spacecraft unconscious, maybe don't put him in the room with the big window facing Earth.
Yeah.
You know? Maybe ease into that a little bit.
Doesn't he get up and wander in there? I don't know.
At some point, he sees it and just freaks out, and which is understandable.
I thought that was a really good scene. He hyperventilates, and they find him, and they try to talk him down, and they're like, look at me. And he's like, no, you don't understand. Yeah. My sister, I take care of her, and I don't know why I'm here. And I thought that was very effective that he is clearly quite upset. He is not like, yippee, I made it to space accidentally. He's actually terrified and concerned about his sister who he takes care of.
His name is Michael. Michael's played by Shamir Anderson.
Yep.
Does an excellent job.
Mm-hmm.
Especially watching it the second time. The emotion that he shows, especially in these early scenes, is really, really believable. We learn a little bit later on, because he has this background, right? He has worked for Hyperion, which is the company I assumed is kind of like fictional SpaceX. Like, it's just the company who does all this stuff.
Yeah.
He's worked for them for a long time. He's actually working on getting his master's degree in engineering. And so he knows about the spacecraft. And he's like, look, I'm not just going to sit around. I'll be helpful to you. I can learn. I already know a lot of stuff. And it comes out a little bit later that one of the changes that's happened to this ship is that initially it was designed for 2 crew members. And when they went to 3, they lightened some of the protections, especially around this module that's now been damaged. So you have this decision that was made probably years ago, and then it's damaged. And now instead of a ship designed for 2 people, it's designed for 3, but now you have 4, and you can begin to put it together that This is going to be a problem.
Yeah, this is. So there's a famous, I think not credited in this story, in this movie, but it should be, famous short story by a guy named Tom Godwin called The Cold Equations. It was published in Astounding Science Fiction in 1954. It has been adapted into film. Cold Equations is exactly this. It is a story about a stowaway on a spaceship, and with an extra person consuming air, they won't have enough air, and everybody on the spaceship will die, which means somebody has to die. That is The Cold Equation. So in a way, this is a classic story, and in fact, that's the thing about Stowaway that made me not want to watch it, is I was like, well, it's The Cold Equations. It's going to be like, it's like, imagine if they did 12 Angry Men, but one of them had to die. Like, one of them had to get kicked out of the jury room, and the jury room was in space. It's like that. It's this tense, like, talk of, like, what do we do? And that's in Stowaway, but the whole movie isn't that, which I liked, because it is an interesting philosophical question, and so we get it, where the crew is like, well, first off, I think it's really interesting that they assume that since he's the problem, he's the solution, which is like, I don't think I would agree with that like, just because he was here accidentally, then clearly he's the one who needs to die. There is a moment where the captain, Barnett, that's Toni Collette, is on the radio basically saying, well, can it be me?
Yeah.
She volunteers to Mission Control to kill herself in order to save the three mm-hmm. people on the ship. And I thought that was a really good touch, because without that, it's a lot harder to watch the rest of this. That she's tried, and they're like, no, they can't operate the ship. This is, I think, structurally one of the reasons why the other characters are novices, is because you got to have it that Toni Collette's character has to run the ship, because she's the one who's been really well trained. But at least she's like, I will sacrifice myself to save mm-hmm. the other people on this. But once that's done, it's very much like, well, obviously we're going to get rid of Michael. And it's like, really? Because, like, I think, could you draw lots, maybe? Something like that?
Sure.
Instead of just, and they're like, don't tell him, which is another thing. It's like, oh, don't tell him. We don't have enough air. Don't tell him. Which then Daniel Day Kim, David,
he tells him.
Just tells him. Yeah. And hands him an injector that he's gotten out of Zoe's medical stores. That's like, just overdose on this and you'll die. And it'll be, you'll be like going to sleep.
Yeah, because in the time between him being found and this problem sort of being settled in on everybody, they do begin to connect. So, like, Michael yeah. and David are working in David's lab together. They talk about jazz music. Zoe has to go in and check out the damage module with him. So they're trying right. to build connections between the crew. And it is interesting that the commander volunteers, and we see David basically wreck his research in an attempt to generate enough oxygen. You know,
it's like a last ditch attempt to get enough oxygen, is that he uses all the algae he was going to use on Mars, and he uses it then in order to try to generate enough oxygen because the thing isn't going to be fixed. And that's, I think that's a really great scene between Daniel Day Kim and Toni Collette, where like she knows before anyone else that thing is not going to get fixed, and that they're in deep trouble. And there are scenes where you see the burden on her, and she's trying to figure out how to deal with it, and then also how to communicate that to the rest of the crew. And then she finally does, where he's like, well, yeah, but he's making the impassioned case, you know, I need to save this. This is why I'm here. You know, are we sure we've tried everything? And she's like, yeah, we've tried everything. And that's honestly, I think one of the problems with this movie is it's so focused on the people on the ship, which is, that's the story it wants to tell. But like, it's very hard to have drama about characters who are not cut off from the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, just as with Apollo 13, there are dozens of people back home who are the experts, who are trying every single thing possible to figure out how to save the crew. And yet the crew is like, I have some ideas. What about this? What about this? What about this? And the response has to be, no, they've all been considered. The answer is no. And it makes your characters kind of powerless, I think, or makes what they want to do almost pointless. And even if they do something and it succeeds, I think the challenge there is, why wasn't that sent up from the ground?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, you could fudge it a little bit, and they sort of do, but like, that was one of the problems I had with it, is like, when you're in a scene with Toni Collette and Daniel Day Kim, if they're cut off from Earth or something, it's very dramatic because they're trying to solve the problem, and she's like, I've already worked the problem. But instead it's like, yeah, the guys say it's not gonna happen, like,
yeah.
That's it. And what do you say to that, which leads to what I wrote down as the saddest botany ever, which is, he kills all his plants and throws them out, and he's just the saddest of all botanies of all time.
Spins the algae up.
Yeah.
Spoiler alert, that doesn't work.
It doesn't, which is you know, doubly tragic, right? Because David has given up all of his stuff and it didn't work anyway.
Right. Yeah, it's a heartbreaker.
Yeah, I like the drama on board, the fact that there are people back in Mission Control who are the authorities on this, presumably, and trying to save them. I don't know. It's tricky. I see how they've structured the movie to make it that the characters can have the drama on the ship, but it's hard knowing that in reality, they would be relying on the people back in Mission Control to tell them what to do. And that's not good drama for a four-person in a locked room drama, which is what this is, but that's what it would be. And short of like cutting themselves off from Earth, which doesn't happen, that would have been a way to do it, where they had to figure it out themselves. But instead, it's in this weird in-between space. Also, they use the term unmanned at one point here, and I was just like, come on. We don't use that word anymore.
Yeah, I think Zoe says, like, why can't they just send more up? And it kind of gets to, well, we're moving too fast.
Yes.
Too bad.
And also, it's not called Unmanned anymore. Stop.
The thing that sort of comes up in this part of the movie is that Zoe hasn't given anything up to try to make this better, right? So David gave up basically his life's research. The commander was willing to give up her life, but Zoe hasn't had the opportunity or hasn't come up with a way to risk herself to try to save him.
Right.
And they've become friends throughout this time. Like, we learn more about his background. His parents died in an apartment fire, and he had to raise his kid daughter, or his kid sister, excuse me.
Yeah.
And so, like, they have a bit of a connection. And I want to come back to that at the end, because I think the human connection is an interesting point in this movie. But it seems like that it's building up for Zoe to do something here.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Like, this is the moment where you realize that they're talking about this, and like, we're gonna have to get rid of David. That's just how it's gonna be. And Zoe isn't having it. And like, as a character moment, I really like that. She's like, no, I will not accept this. We are not gonna just resign ourselves to this. And what she's really saying, and you're right, this sets up what happens in this movie, which is, look, we gotta try to save him. Even if it kills us, we gotta try to save him. Like, that's her worldview is, you're looking at this as one of us has to die to keep the other three alive. I'm looking at it as we need to expend every effort so that all of us live.
Yeah.
And if all of us die because we tried to have all of us live, so be it. But letting three of us live and being comfortable letting the other person die is not something that I am willing to do. And that's, philosophically, that's really interesting. That's the idea that, you know, the needs of the many and the needs of the few. That's an old Star Trek reference. But this is a philosophical argument, which is, do you make an effort that would risk everybody to save one person? Or do you say, well, it's just one person, I'm going to make sure everybody else is okay. Complicated by the fact that this is also a problem, and it's unclear whether they're going to be safe regardless. But like, Zoe is like, I'm not going to participate in this way. We have to figure this out. And she suggests for the first time getting to the liquid oxygen, which, like I said earlier, I think is sort of explained away as that ground control, like mission control, knows that that's an option. But obviously, whoever is making the decisions down there has also decided that it's too dangerous for the crew to do it. And she's saying again, I don't care if it's too dangerous. We need to try.
Yeah.
And that kicks off the rest of the movie, essentially. But I really appreciate it that Zoe's the one who's essentially the advocate, who says, I'm not willing to just sort of stand by. I'm willing to risk my life to see if we can save everybody here.
Yeah, I like it too. And we see her struggle with it. I mean, she opens up to Michael after he's been given the news, and at some point she's like crying on her bunk. I mean, she's really invested in this idea of, hey, we can all make it. Just giving up and deciding to kill this one guy is not acceptable to her.
And the story that she tells that is perfectly kind of elaborative of her worldview is the story about how she was not a lifeguard, but she was working on a beach and she saw somebody struggling, and she goes out into the water, and then she's struggling to try to keep his head above water, and it's like they're both going to drown, and then somebody is there with a boat and pulls them both to safety, and Michael says something like, how did you know you would be saved? And she's like, nope, I didn't. Like, she's just like, I did my part to try and save somebody, and I took a risk, right? She's like, in fact, this story reminds me a lot of what we're going through now. No, she doesn't say that, because that would be the screenwriter saying that. But it's a good moment of her character. And I actually thought that was kind of a beautiful little anecdote that perfectly fits with the movie. But I really liked it. So this is... Also, there's a nice bit of turnabout, because, you know, the empathy that's shown for David's character, Daniel Day Kim's character, is good too. Because he's like the... tells Michael he's got to die. Here's his shot. Take this and you'll fall asleep. And it's like almost villainous. And when he's confronted about it, there's a really nice turn where he's like, what do you mean I haven't tried? I literally threw away the whole 2 years of this mission, everything I was going to do to try to save him. It didn't work, But it's not like I didn't try. I sacrificed all of my things for this. And I really like that because it's the movie getting you back on his side. That you know, just because he already processed and accepted that this was going to happen and Zoe hasn't, it doesn't mean that he didn't make personal sacrifices in order to try to save the people on the ship. And I thought that was a really nice moment to remind us that he's not a bad guy who just wants this guy out of their hair. He's already done the sad botany, so he's already there.
The saddest botany.
It's the saddest botany ever. It is. So okay, so the algae is dead. it's all brown.
Got to climb the tether. That's what
time to climb.
That's what she comes around to. They just happen to have all the stuff you need to do that. By the way, the thing you're not supposed to do.
Yeah. Well, it must be for emergency situations or something. But that they decided that this was not worth the risk. And there's some tension again that's played down because we never hear anybody that's off the ship. But I would imagine that there is a parallel conversation happening at Mission Control where there are people saying they need to do this. We can save this guy if they climb over. And somebody else higher up on the chain is like, no. It's too risky. But they just decide they're going to do it. I was imagining during this whole thing, too, like, are they also broadcasting all this? Because, like, there is that scene where they're talking to people on Earth, and I'm like, is this just riveting television, these people trying to save themselves, or does nobody care, or are they not broadcasting it to everyone? I don't know how routine it is, but we get to watch it because it's a movie. As Daniel Day-Kim and Anna Kendrick climb in their spacesuits up these tethers, which is a fun bit of physics, right? So they're spinning.
Mm-hmm.
So everything everything is kind of spinning in the background as they do it. And Daniel Day-Kim is like, whoa, this is making me queasy. But it starts at 1G. But the further you go up toward the center, toward where the solar panels are, you go to weightlessness. And then you have to flip around, and then you're coming down into 1G the other direction, which is they do the math and they know that's how it is. And then that informs the drama because it's the exertion to climb up and then don't mess up the solar panels and very clearly kind of float over them in zero G. And then you have to clip on and like rappel back down to the other side.
Right. Because the gravity is going to pick up as you get closer.
Right.
To the big rocket that's swinging around, you know, at the same speed as the cabin you were in. Yeah, it is fun. And it's like,
right.
It gets easier as you get to the middle and then you have to slide down and you have to like use the climbing mechanism as a brake so you don't slam into the top of the rocket. It is fun. And it is, I suppose, pretty accurate in the way that this would work.
Yeah, I think, and somebody can convince me if I'm wrong, but I think the gravity would be, you know, it's not gravity, but, you know, the
right.
centrifugal force would be a little bit more, I'm not sure it's exactly as depicted, but it's good enough. Like, it's good enough to say, okay, yeah, that I understand that you spin things up and that basically their inertial force is going to push them down and that's how you get artificial gravity. Good enough to deal with this story.
I mean, the movie talks about it as up and down, but really it's in and out.
Yeah, Yeah, into the center where it's basically not spinning, and then back out to where it's spinning, and then mm-hmm. you get that force imparted on you.
Yep.
And so it's, you know, this is where they spent their money, because you got to have this climactic scene in space, and
yep.
This is, you know, Daniel Day-Kim struggles with climbing, and then they finally get there, and you get the ticking clock because she puts the thing on, and it basically opens up the valve, which means that the oxygen is going to leak a little bit, which means they need to do this fairly quickly. But they do have enough oxygen to fill two canisters and basically get enough oxygen to have it be breathable when they get back to the other side of the ship. And this is their Hail Mary. This is what they have to do in order to get this to work. And so she fills up a canister and she's filling up another one when the movie says, oh, but it's a lot like For All Mankind. For people who haven't seen that, there is a scene that's like this, which is there's a solar storm. Everybody needs to get inside.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, well, that was really inconvenient, but it provides the extra twist of having, basically, like, you have to drop everything and come back,
mm-hmm.
which I have some questions about this because, like, I don't know why you wouldn't, like, close the valves and leave the tanks there and just go back and say, we're going to have to try this again later.
Yeah.
But instead, they leave the valve open. They leave the one thing on. They bring one of the oxygen tanks with them, but it's like, you're going to have to go back.
Yeah. The other one is still, like, hooked up in the rocket where they tapped the liquid oxygen line.
Yeah.
I mean, I think they sort of hand wavily did it of like, oh, make sure there's not a big leak around where you puncture the pipe. Like, basically, the problem is it's still venting. And if you wait too long...
Right. That's the ticking clock.
Right. And then when the first canister is lost, because Anna Kendrick comes down too fast and basically bounces off the roof and goes into space, now it's, okay, well, now two people can live.
From the perspective of the end of the movie, you realize why it's structured the way it is, right? And they very carefully structured this to have the sequence of events be what it is. And so the reason they bring the one canister back is so she can drop it. And that and the solar storm is there, and that leads to the ultimate kind of spin on the cold equations, which is we only have enough oxygen for two. We have four. There's a solar storm that's not going to abate until after the oxygen has depleted out of the rocket. So if somebody doesn't go out in the solar storm, two of us will have to die.
Mm-hmm.
If somebody does go out into the solar storm, they will die, but they can bring back oxygen so that the other three will live. So who's going to sacrifice themselves for the other three? Which is, it's the spin on it. Now it's, instead of it being, if you're the three who will live, will you risk your lives for the one who will not? And now it's, three will live if the one risks their life, or, you know, sacrifices their life for the other three. It's flipping the sacrifice around. And this is the moment that it's very obvious what's going to happen, which is Anna Kendrick says, I'll do it. Because
mm-hmm.
This is where this whole movie has been leading. And so we see a very, I think, affecting kind of montage of her going back up on her own and refilling the canister and bringing it back and basically sort of like dropping it in the hole. I was like wondering, how is this going to end? And she sort of like drops it in the hole and of like, here you go. And they're looking at her out of like a window. And then she sort of sits and admires the universe and is looking kind of off at Mars in the distance. And the solar storm looks like a big aurora is blowing around, which, again, I think like For All Mankind showed it. I don't think solar storms work like this. I think they're invisible because they're just charged particles. I could be wrong. Maybe if they had, certainly out in the middle of space, I doubt that there's like dust blowing past you in a solar storm. I think it's more invisible lethal radiation than that. And I'm also not sure, like, the impression that I get is that by the time she's done all of this, she's basically about to die, which I also don't think it happens. I think it's more like Chernobyl, where she would be horribly radiation burned. And, you know, maybe her intent is to more sort of like open up the spacecraft or the spacesuit. I also had a question, which was, don't they need the spacesuit?
Well, that, and don't they need the mass of the liquid oxygen in the rocket to keep spinning at the speed they're spinning?
Well, no, because it's going to continue spinning, but then they're going to how are they going to get out of it? Are they going to untether and just let it kind of fly off and fall apart? I have lots of questions there.
Yeah.
They're not really relevant to the emotional core of the movie, but I have a lot of questions about it because the oxygen tank is going to be empty. I assume that this MTS is basically a total loss because they don't have they would have to replace the life support at the very least. So it's not in great shape. It's unclear. It really is not the point. At this point, it's really just about Zoe's sacrifice, and she sort of sits outside. Because I thought, you know, she could come back inside, but then she's just going to die horribly. They could give her that injection, and then she falls asleep. Because that's probably what you should do. Although I did think that if she's just sitting out there and that's where she dies, then they could just go out and, like, get her after she's dead and the storm has passed. But the movie does not want us to think about these things. The movie wants us just have Zoe sort of like quietly reflecting on her life, sitting out in outer space before she dies, having sacrificed herself so that the other three people will probably live unless, you know, there are more technical problems between here and Mars.
So this is where we get to my big problem.
All right.
I just don't care that she sacrificed herself. Like, this movie is very effective at moving its plot forward, I feel like. But they try to build this connection between these characters. Like, so between Zoe and David, for instance, at the beginning, we learn that he went to Harvard. She went to Yale. She trolls him by bringing Yale coffee mugs and making him drink out of it without his knowledge. And then at the end, where she decides to go outside for the last time, she's like, no, I'll go. You get home. You have a kid. You send him to Yale for me. Like, trying to pull on that thread that they're sort of teasing each other about this, but it's really important to them as a friendship. it's just not enough. Like, I just feel like we don't know enough about these people. We don't know enough about their lives outside of Michael's little sister that he cares for to really care which one of them opens the hatch. And I think a lot of that, for me at least, falls at the feet of the plot point to decide there's only four people in this movie, right? If we got to see Zoe's family back home, if we knew more about her in the past, and I don't know, maybe that makes me like cold-hearted, but I just like, yeah, she did it. Okay. I don't feel like the movie earns the payoff that it's trying to reach emotionally.
I see what you're saying. I think what I would say is that at no point do I not think Zoe is going to do this, if that makes any sense. The idea that, like, her character doesn't change, right? Her character is destined to do this almost. Mm-hmm. Like, she, from the moment she makes the first argument, it's very clear that she's going to be the one who makes the sacrifice. And I think this movie might have been more effective if she has to take a little bit of a journey, if there's a little, like, I don't know. I think bottom line is this is a low to mid budget movie with a limited number of characters, good actors, play like structure of being all trapped in the spacecraft together. That's all fine, but maybe the problem is that so much time is spent on some of the details of the plot that not enough time is spent with the characters. But I think you're right. I think the challenge is that the plot seems constructed so that it can get the result it wants, and the characters are on paths so they can lead to the end of the screenplay. And it doesn't feel natural or a series of kind of like human conflicts that lead to this point. Mm-hmm. I never feel like Zoe is really anything but the person who's destined to sacrifice herself.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it's just, I actually think this is a pretty good movie for what it is, which is a low budget kind of space movie with some action and some things that make you think. But on another level, I think it is a failure because it doesn't ever really make me think. It doesn't ever really surprise me. I don't know. In some ways, I think I might even say, if I was a movie critic writing a review of this, I would probably play with the idea that this is set in a world where travel to Mars is routine. And the problem with that is that everything in this movie is also routine. Like, it's just, I was never surprised by this movie. Not well. Okay, if I hadn't seen the trailer, I would have been surprised that there was a guy. Also, the name is Stowaway,
right?
But that would have been a surprise. It was like, well, what's going to be the thing? What accident's going to befall them? And it's like, there's a guy on the spaceship. That is truly a surprising thing, except it's baked into the premise, and so you know it going in. But otherwise, it's like, yeah. Again, I like space stuff. I think they do a creditable job with the space stuff. I think that the actors are really good, but yeah, there's something missing. There's something missing, and the way I would phrase it is that it's I'm never surprised by Zoe. So yes, maybe it would be more successful if we saw her family or if we knew more about her. But I don't get any of that. Instead, it's just sort of like she's clearly the person who's going to sacrifice herself at the end. There's never a question. I would have loved a movie that left you in suspense until the hatch opens about who is going to go out there. Is it going to be Michael sacrificing himself? Is it going to be David, who already has done his sad botany thing? He's got nothing else to live for, right? Because his plants died. Or is it Zoe who is the one who sort of instigated this, we have to save him? Or is it the captain who's decided that she's going to go against the rules and let the rest of the crew figure it out? I would love a version of this movie where we don't know who opens the hatch to go sacrifice themselves. This is not that movie.
And in fact, I feel like out of the characters that do make an emotional journey, I feel like David has the most, right? Where he is begrudgingly, but then eventually sort of on board with ruining his research. He's also the one who decides to try to give this stowaway guy a way out. And he's the one that's got, as far as we know, other than Michael, the only other person who has another human being on Earth they care about, because we know he's married. And so I feel like we know more about him and we see his journey more than we see Zoe's. But I don't think we're in disagreement here. I just think that it could be richer in a lot of ways.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Well, I think that does it.
I think so. Is there anything else out there that you want to recommend? Do you want to recommend a space movie?
Oh gosh,
that other people could watch. I'm going to recommend one.
Okay.
If you liked or didn't like Stowaway, and I know I've mentioned it before on Liftoff, but I'm going to mention it here. Europa Report. It is, believe it or not, a found footage space movie, which is very strange combination of genres, but I really liked it. It is available in a bunch of places. It's available on Hoopla and Canopy, which you can get from your local library usually. I'd recommend those. I think it's on Plex as well. If you're a Plex subscriber user, you could do that, and then you can also rent it. But that, I like that. I think the science in that, it's been a few years since I saw it. It's from 2013. Similarly, a kind of low budget space movie that still, I think, makes an attempt to get the science right. And if we talk about on Liftoff a lot about exploring the icy moons of Jupiter and Saturn, and of course, Europa is the most tantalizing of all of them. And Europa Report is about a crewed mission to Europa that is super exciting and also kind of creepy. And I enjoyed it a lot. So check that one out.
I mean, I think I would just tell people to go finish For All Mankind if you haven't yet.
There you go.
Go do it.
All right. Solid. And thank you for being a Relay FM member, right? That's the, I guess, the last message to leave everybody with is, everybody listening to this is a member of Relay FM. You're supporting something on Relay FM, maybe some multiple things. And whether it's Liftoff or something else, I do Upgrade on this network. Steven has a couple other podcasts on this network. You know, we're around. So thank you for your support, whether it's directly to Liftoff or whether it's to one of the many other fine shows here on this fine podcast network that Steven and Mike have created. Thank you.
Yes, thank you all. I would say if you are a member and you're not in the Discord, go check that out. It's a great community in there. Well, Jason, we've done it. We survived another space movie. Better than some others we've seen. Not as good as others. I think squarely in the middle.
I didn't dislike this movie. I just wish that I wish it was better. But yeah, it was fine. It was nice. I honestly, Stephen, I was dreading it. I was dreading that it was going to be very much just a Cold Equations ripoff. And I'm glad that it was more than that. I kind of wish it was more The Martian than it was. But I like that they have a problem that they're trying to solve. And so yeah, I'm glad I took the journey, and I'm glad that we got to talk about it.